accession number 23175, Rule 3.
Mr. Hastings, Rule 3. Can you take me through a typical day in this camp where you're working with horses?
Yes, we rise at Rivali at 6 o'clock. We're up past 6. I just forget now. The reason of that, sir. Then we'd all parade and clean the horse, muck the horses out, take all the straw, the bed now, as we call it, and lay it outside to air off and that. And some of that we'd replace later on. Then we'd take the horses out for the water the horses, as they call it. Or if they're going out on rough exercise in the winter time, we put the blankets on, let them up, and we'd go out and take them out. If it was there in the summertime, the training season, we'd put saddles on and all that. We'd report back at 9 o'clock to put the saddles on, everything like that, and all the harness, the gun limbers and all that, you see. And it was very interesting. And sometimes we'd have to take a horse out somewhere to pull a roller, to roll a bit of a road out or something like that. There's various things in the wintertime we use horses for. But one day I had to take a horse up to Oxley Pond. And around the Oxley Pond, I had to fix it to a roller and straighten all the pond all around it. Yeah, and bring it back at dinner time, put the horse away again, things like that.
So there's very much activity with horses during the day.
Yes.
In the usual meal times.
Yeah.
There must have been a lot of cleaning and polishing with...
The harness, yes, there was. You used to have all the harness in the room then, you had to burnish it with, like, chain things. They're all steel, they'd be all polished up with these chain things like that. You had a hooker thing on the long chains and all that, and the leather ones, and put the polish on and all that. And I got on your belt and pull it tight like that while you clean it all up and all that. Yeah.
And again, inspected.
And then it was all hung up and it was inspected by the officer sergeant and the officer and things like that. So when you put the harness on, all the horses were inspected and the harness was on correctly and it was cleaned correctly. That was very important, that.
And you mentioned the fact that you had to get the horses used to crowds and sounds.
Yes, we did that at the depot, based nearby London, you see, Woolwich. Well, they used to take us in East Square, they called it. It was like a big, wide square. We used to line up on both sides with tins and shouting and waving flags and that. And they'd bring the horses out, ride them out, slowly through there, and the horses were putting them out. And they'd have to get used to the crowds, you see. And they did used to. If you brought them out, the new ones, they were dodgy. And eventually, they got used to it. They used to walk quite calmly through it. Well, the noise. Very interesting.
When horses were fully limbered up, what vehicles or equipment was with a limbered up horse or horses?
Well, the horses were, there were six in a team to pull a gun limber and a gun. And there was the first two horses, called the wheel horses, and the driver sat on one side. And he had a leg iron on, because there's a iron pole come out the limber, you see, to uncrush his leg. They called that the wheel. And there's the centre one, with nothing on like that, and the lead horse, and the lead two in the middle, in the front, rather. And you had to learn how to... We had people who were specialised in being the drivers of the horses. I was a gunner, but you still had to learn to ride the horses as well. But when we were going in there, my basic role was a gunner. I had to jump off the limbs, I've already said. If they got the traces come untangled, undo the traces and right up again the outside of them so they could pull the limber all right, you see, and jump back on again. And we used to gallop across the Shrewsbury Plains with an 18-pounder gun on the back, and that was it was really fantastic. It was a bit frightening at times, like when they got the hang of it. He said he'd enjoy it, look forward to it.
So there's six horses.
Yes.
And then the limber. Can you describe a limber?
The limber was a two-wheel limber, like. And there's a pole come through it, like I've already described, for the first two horses, like. And on the back of the limber, you had your 25-pound or 4.5, I would say. Yes. Now, the limb there had a shaft through it. The horse either side of that faced up to it, and the other four in front of them, the centre and the lead horses, six altogether. Now, in the back of the limb there was hooked the gun. The bottom end of the gun, the trail end of the gun, was a linking part to go onto the limber to pull it. And the barrel of the gun was at angled out the back of it. And that's how we used to go across the plains. And we're moving, you see.
And didn't the limber have places for the shells to go in? Did they carry, the limber, did that also carry the shells?
Oh, yes. They carried the shells of the limber, yes, and all that business, yeah.
How many shells would there be? How many shells does a limber hold?
Well, I just forget now. I would say about, roughly about eight, but I can remember. I just forget that long ago.
So you've got a driver on the first horse, you're saying?
Yeah.
Who was sitting on the limber?
The two gunners. The gunners, they had to undo the gun, drop it down, and on the gun itself, there was a big round platform. And they dropped that, and they took the limber, the spare piece of the limber for the recoil, dug in the ground, dropped that on the floor. They took this thing off, and they run it round to the front of the gun, put it on the floor, and they have to lift the limber up and run the gun onto this thing, so the wheels just come on the edge of this thing, so they could stand on this turntable easy, with precision, you see, easy to turn round, to angle the gun where they wanted it. And that would be fastened to the platform. And when the gun fired, the recoil, it didn't run off the platform altogether. It was a good idea. Just like a flat wheel, big wheel. It was great, yeah.
Very physical work.
Big man?
Very physical. You had to be very fit.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah. You all know what to do. That's why you train as a team. And you get used to doing what. I mean, you might have seen it in the telly, the Marines and what have you, in the Navy, they put teams on to pack guns. They strip them down, put them together, get quick, don't they? Well, we didn't do as far as that, but what we had to do was on the same thing, that same idea.
A very efficient team, how long would it take, say, to unlimber and have a gun ready for action?
Oh, probably a minute or two. Now, in the Sudbury Plains, they used to have blown-up tanks, a wooden tank made covered with black cloth, and would come out of a dip or somewhere. You'd be driving along there, and all of a sudden one of these tanks would come up. We had to stop straight away, drop it on the platform, and start finding this tank. We had to be very, very quick on it. That's why we had to train, to get that clockwork-like precision.
Were there any accidents in training?
Oh, yes, now and then you got one. It's not a serious one, though, yeah. People fall over sometimes, which is understandable.
What were the punishments that could be meted out to anyone who made a mistake or did something wrong?
Punishments? Well, there's nothing really. The only punishment I would say is that they train more training.
Didn't have men put on fatigues because?
Oh no, if they made a mistake like that, they weren't trained. They had to keep on the train until they achieved what they were trying to do. You see.
So you don't recall anyone being severely punished in any form?
No, no.
In the olden days,
if they're a bit slow, the team were a bit slow. They find out the officer or the sergeant in charge, find out where the weakness was, and they train on that to get more used to it so they could manage that, cope with it, you see, which is understandable, isn't it?
In the normal course of events, did you have fatigues to do, like cookhouse fatigues or cleaning fatigues?
Oh, yes, we all had cookhouse fatigues. At 9 o'clock parade, we were sent various places in there, you know. As I've just previously said, I had to go to Oxley Pond once over with a horse to pull a roll around the pond and roll things out. Things like that. And I might be sent around cleaning the lawns up or something like that, the battery lawns, paper and that. Or even cutting the feed up for horses, put the straw through the oats and that, through a machine, you had to chop it all up to mix with the oats and everything. Because a horse, when that they eat the straw as well, and they used to try and blow down the nostrils, try and blow the straw, we mixed that with water, so they couldn't blow the chopped up straw out, you see. They had to eat that, things like that. We learned all that. It was quite interesting, very interesting, I thought.
How many guns in a battery?
Four.
And they would be commanded by?
The average one was four. I think the Sergeant Major, but the average in four, yeah.
And who commanded the battery?
The rank
of the person.
Well, the GPO, the gun position officer.
And would he, was he a lieutenant or a...
He'd be an officer, lieutenant or captain, yeah.
And who, was there an NCO in command of each gun?
Oh, yes, yes, sergeant, yeah. Sometimes a sergeant and a bombardier.
Do you recall any of the battery commanders that you had at this time? Do you recall the names of any of them?
No, I can't. I know one man we had. He had a spare up, a rough ride. He was very good at breaking in new horses, had to break them in, just like you say to the cowboys or the fishers at time. That we did things like that, yeah. And one man got what he called a sunfish. He got killed. A horse was breaking in. It bucked him up a bit. It put my ears the trim. He broke his back on it. He died, unfortunately. He was a full bombardier, he was. Things happen like that in the army, like in the training. Fortunately, it doesn't happen much, like. But it does happen when you have to train these horses, you say. You've got to go through all that. Well, that's done in the winter months, I suppose, when there's not much training going on, you say. It's in the summertime when you really go training. But you've got to keep the horses, like the men, in tip-top condition.
Were they breeding their own horses, the army, or were they buying them in?
Well, I think they bought them in. I don't quite know much about that. Now, we got new horses now and then, where they come from. I know where to break them in ourselves. And some of these sergeants had a degree, has been what they call a rough rider. And they were a dab hand to breaking these horses in. We used to help them. We used to do it, help where we could, you see, with them. I think I used to people mounting them and dismounting them and riding on the backs and what have you, at a gallop, a canter, and a trot. When they're on a trot, you had to keep going like that, and down, and sadly, you've probably seen on the telly and that.
Mm. Moving, what was the method of moving a regiment across country?
Across where?
Across country. How did you move across country?
Across country?
Yeah. Were you spread out, or in lines, or what have you?
Well, you mean open, not on the
open,
road?
Open country.
Open,
yeah.
Country. Well, it varied. Sometimes we spread out, sometimes we just follow across like that. Yeah. You see, we could only go on the moors. We couldn't go across farmland, you can understand that. Is it going moorland like that? No, that means, yes, no manoeuvres and that. Shrewsbury Plains are wide open spaces. That was a good training area.
And on the on the roads, you'd be behind each other?
Yes. Another thing, when you were on exercise, you had to drive too close to the horse in front of you. They call that treading in, because the horse you ride and he got too close to the horse in front of you, his hoofs could touch the back of the horse's hoofs in front of you. They call that treading in. We had to avoid things like that. We also had the hoof picks, and if they're limping a bit, we pick the hoofs up. We'd have this hoof pick with us, and there'd be a stone caught in there. In the show, we had to pull that out, you see, because the horse was uneven with it. We had to think about things like that. We had to look after horses in general, things like that.
And you'd have your own blacksmiths?
Yes, we had our own blacksmiths, put the shows on everything, yes.
And veterinary surgeons,
veterinary
people?
Veterinary surgeons, we had all them with us, yes. Hmm. Well, they were well looked after, the horses, I can tell you.
What happened to you next, then, when you moved to this place and you're now with the unit? What happened?
The what?
What was the next thing you did, that you personally did?
Well, I think I've covered everything, personally. Well,
How long were you with this particular unit? What was the unit number, by the way?
The 19th Field Brigade. Colonel Russell was the CO.
And did you have a name and number for your battery?
Yes, it's the 39 battery I was in. Yeah.
So how long were you with them?
I was with them about 12 months, and I got me discharged because my stepfather passed on, like, and wouldn't want me home, yeah.
And do you recall how that came about? I know you said your stepfather died, but how did your mother get you out?
Well, I found out, I inquired about it, and my mother got me a job. I could get me discharged on compassionate grounds. And I was oldest in the family, mother really needed me. And we had a bit of a job at times, like, but my mother could have went to the MP, like, and seen him, like, and I didn't get that far. And eventually they gave me discharge. They were going to send me to India at first, like.
How did you feel about being discharged?
Well, I didn't want to leave the army. I liked it, but at the same time, my mother had a, as I've told you before, she had a job bringing me up, being my sister, and I owed her something, and it was only right, I think, and that was it. And I said, well, I said, I'll, as soon as I go, I said, I'll join the territorials. So if a war does come, like, well, I'm not judging anything, which I did do, and I got called up in 39.
You went back to the territorials first? After coming out of the regular
yes,
army?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Mm. And what, was that 5th Battalion again?
No, I went in the 186 first, and I got out of that one, and I joined the Durhams again. I wasn't in there long.
What was the 186?
186 was the Royal Artillery. And that'd be out of there for some reason or other. I forget now what it was. It was very childish, but the territories don't work exactly like the regular army, like, and I seen where things were going. I just kept a low profile and went with the rest, which is sort of a wise thing.
And you weren't with them long, you say, 186?
I did one camp with them at Reesdale. I haven't got that on my records anyway now. But it was only in a few months.
And then you came out back to the...
Back to the Durhams, yeah. I was in the Durham Light Infantry and we got changed into searchlights. Just before the war, got changed into searchlights. We got stationed, I was at Eastfields Farm in Yorkshire.
How did you feel about changing from infantry to searchlights?
Well, I don't know, searchlights are something new to me. I look forward to something new, you see. And I got into MT then, driving lorries. I never didn't have a driving licence at the time. I learned to drive their gun-towing vehicles.
When you changed to searchlights, did the number of the regiment change? Did you have a new title?
As far as it was just the same one. And then later on, I went on MT course and I got with the highest marks. And they wanted to re-gun us for the Air Force and I applied for that. And they wouldn't let me go because I'd put the highest marks in the course. And later on, brought all the searchlights in. We took them to Scarborough, just outside of Scarborough, with our regiment headquarters. We were there a few months, and some of us transferred then to a driver training unit at Diebold Camp at Barnard Castle. We learned to drive heavy guns there, and all, heavy vehicles and guns and all that. Then I was transferred to a regiment down the south.
Before we come to those, you transferred from, well, the 5th Battalion Durhams became a searchlight regiment.
Yeah.
Can you describe the searchlights that you were getting those in those early days?
Yes, they were just, they've still got the same searchlights now, I've seen them on shows and that, like, that single searchlight could walk around with it, had another one on a big stand and a big sound locator connected with a 9-pound cable or something, and this would work with levers and all that. The sound went round like that, and as it went round, it turned the searchlight round with it. So when they decided to strike out and got on target, the searchlight straight hit their target upstairs. The gunners could fire at it.
It was as efficient as that. It, as you say, based on the locators, really, wherever they went, the searchlight went.
Yeah.
What the searchlight itself, how large was it?
The searchlight.
Yeah. Did you know its measurements?
Yes, it was. It has not been what I've seen. About 3.5 to 4 feet across the searchlight. And the means of lighting it was like a welder's arc, with carbons in like that, or twitch like that. When you put the switch on, the carbon broke away and formed a arc. And there's a fan taking the debris up so it didn't fall on the mirror at the back. Remember all that, like?
Did you actually train on the searchlights yourself?
Yeah, I've worked the searchlights, yes. I've worked the sound locators. You think of the noise going to send you your head when you're on target. It is the thing like that and goes in. You move it right and left, and you get the sound in the middle of your head, then you know your director you're on. Then you can give the wire and the switch the searchlight on. You had a generator to supply the electric current to the searchlight. That was away in, like, in a Holland.
It was away from
300 yards away or so. So the sound of the generator didn't disturb the sound locator.
Mm. How many would be in a searchlight crew?
Be about six or eight, if I can remember. There was two of them, what do you spot, spotters and chairs that searched the sky with glasses. Two over there, there was two on the door, two over there, yeah. They about six or eight.
And you've mentioned those two. What were the other duties of the members of the team?
Well, some had to search the heavens with their glasses, like. The others had to search with their dunes, and the others were just
the
ready.
Locators.
And another one was on the generator, to start the generator up, like, and keep that going. And he had a field telephone, so they could get in touch with him there, the big bell on it, so it could ring above the noise of the engine. He could pick the phone up. What's the matter? Strike arc or don't strike, turn the engine off, we finish or something like that.
And the actual, as you've said, the locators manoeuvred the searchlight. Prior to that, weren't they separated and there was a long arm on the searchlight? It had to be pushed.
There was
out.
A long arm on the searchlight with a wheel on the end of it. The arm would be about probably 8 feet long or so, eight or 10 feet long. You had the handle on there like a steering wheel, and you moved it around like that, and you turn the wheel round to elevate it, and the other one traversed, so you walk round it like that.
Those would be the early ones, were
they
before?
They're still the same now, they are, yes. But I've seen them, yeah.
And where did you do your initial training on searchlights? Was that at the drill hall?
We did that in the drill hall. And then, of course, we did it at our monthly camp, like. We met them there and we used them there.
How many searchlights would there be in the particular unit itself?
I think about six, if I don't really know. I would say six, roughly six. At least six, anyway, if not eight.
And who was in command?
There's a troop officer in command, and there's all the sergeants out and all that, you see. Troop sergeant and that, and on the various sites. We had like one searchlight on the site. Then we've got cluster sites with three searchlights on the same site. That was the end of it, like.
So we started with single
searchlight
on a
single
site.
Yeah.
What year was this that you said? Was
this would be in 1940 and 41.
So before 40, 41, and where were you? Where did you move? The war came along, obviously. Had you moved from the drill hall then onto some area site?
We'd move there. Yes, we got called up in 39, just before the war started. We moved out to Yorkshire onto search sites there, like on the sites. I was Eastfield's farm, I was. Somewhere in Middlesbrough Park. Then later on, some of us got sent to ICI, not for search lights, but on ground defence only. We could only go on duty during the hours of daylight in case they got attacked by an off-line aircraft. We had Lewis guns to fire and bring the aircraft down. That was in Billingham, that was.
So your first area was the Yorkshire Moors?
Yorkshire Moors, yeah.
Was it pretty primitive?
Yes, we had a common. The first time I got there, I had to sleep in a tent by the generator. The other lads had a common. And sometimes in the winter time, you could lift the tent up, flap like a dog, it was frozen. But I managed all right, put plenty of clothes on that. Blankets and whatever, yeah.
And the others, you say, were in a hut?
The others were in a hut, yes.
Were you the generator man?
I was the generator man. I was the driver of the truck that carried the searchlight, and I had to do the generator as well.
And this was just one, at the beginning, this was one searchlight?
Searchlight, yeah.
Was it protected in any way? Just on the ground, or was it? Wasn't sandbagged in? Or
there was sandbagged. It's a dig a trench, put in a trench like in a way, then put sandbags round it. I might dig about 2 foot down for the searchlight to be in, like you could walk round at the end, like I explained to you. And you might do some sandbags up as well. So you were below if you were attacked, like, you know, some reason precautions were taken.
How far were you from the next searchlight?
But I couldn't say. Let's see.
I mean, was it a good distance away?
There's a searchlight at Middlesbrough Park. And the next one was at Eastfields Farm. That's about, what, 2 miles? Probably 2 miles there. I know that when planes come back and they've been fired upon, come back from Germany, and we got orders to, they used to fly around and send a signal out to someone. We had to put our light up like straight vertical like that and point to the nearest landing ground for them and take it down like that. And they'd get another signal and they'd go to the nearest airfield to land. I had to do with that in the early days.
Was there a lot of that, helping planes back in?
Oh, yes. It quite frequently happened that day, yeah.
Was there any danger of German aircraft being in the area that might...
Oh, yes, there was that danger.
Might spot this and follow the aircraft in?
Well, could have been, yeah, but up now I never experienced it, fortunately, where I was.
In those early days of the war, 1939, when you were on this site, did you have any alarms or actions? Well, you had to, you know, when you got onto German aircraft?
No, just that... get over the sun locators and light the plane up, then the 3-7 guns would be in the same area, they'd start firing their guns at it, hope to bring it down.
Did you actually get onto any while you were there? Do you recall?
We've caught one or two like that, whether they got shot down, or I don't remember them really calling anyone shot down in the vicinity where I was, but some that escapes like. We've illuminated the German plane at times. I don't recall anyone being shut down in the vicinity. There was some shut down outside of our area, here and there, like.
Must have been exciting when it happened.
Oh, yes. You could take post, and I was at Ellerbeck, Farnindales, for a while there in the middle of the Yorkshire Moors. And I've seen it's been up all night there, sometimes there. In fact, used to stand there, and I found out your feet got that cold. When you got stood down, you couldn't sleep with your cold feet. So I said, you're up and down to keep your feet warm all the time. People said, what are you doing, Jim? I've kept your feet warm before I go to bed. You learned all sorts of things like that.
Did it not get some men down, the boredom and the cold and the weather, the conditions they were in?
Well, no, I don't think it did. They'd be bored. We all were bored, but we found something to do, like, going on to Whitby, getting there. It's one day I had to walk from Bluebank Slides from there to Farlandales. I couldn't get a bus. The bus was stopped late at night. We got a bit of leave to go down to the pitches at Whitby. We got a bus down to there. We got as far as Slides, Bluebank. We had to walk from there to the Farlandales. I thought we were not going to get home that night. I had to walk all across the moors.
Where were the nearest civilians to your searchlight?
Well, the nearest civilians were the farmer on the Eastfields Farm. In the Visbella Park, they're all around us there, civilians.
Did they help you? Did you get involved with them?
Oh, yes, they got the girls around the site, like, you know. They always were like, you know, and a bit fun like that. And that's all like, you know, which is a norm, isn't it?
Did the farmers invite you in for meals or...?
Some of them did, yes.
Relaxation?
Yeah.
And did you get involved with in the summer with helping them with the harvest?
Not where I've been. I've been involved slightly in it, like a bit here and there, like I understand, like yeah.